from day to day with the condition.
Well, you've certainly come to the right place, and everybody here on the call, and we're going to be getting some latecomers too, I'm sure they all can understand, empathize, and they'll be able to share their experiences. Right now we have Inam on the line as well. She's had gastroparesis as well as other things. And I have gastroparesis, so I'm sorry in one respect that we all need to gather here, but on the other respect, I'm so glad that we have this opportunity to really help each other out with information. It can be very challenging, both emotionally and physically, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Typically in these groups, what I do, but not always, is I'll share some information. Sometimes we'll have guests, but sometimes I focus on a topic, and then I present it to everybody, and you can either respond to that topic or you can go off and just say, look, I'm here because I want to know this, or I just need to talk, whatever the case may be. So just consider this as an extended family for you of people who truly do understand.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate being in with this group talk.
Oh, I'm delighted that you're able to come. Because,
I'm delighted.
And again, you'll hear me talk about this, how really isolating it can be. And sometimes when you read things online, it's good to, it empowers you to educate yourself, and that's always a good thing. But on the other hand, sometimes when you read things, you begin to panic and go, oh my God, is this going to happen to me? Is that going to happen to me? And so I will be addressing that as well, just to know that perhaps some of the symptoms that you're getting may not correspond with what you know about it, but there are many different presentations of this, and there are many misconceptions, which I will be talking about as well on gastroparesis. So hopefully you'll feel comfortable enough to just share whatever you want to share, questions, feelings, concerns.
I just have something to say to Kathy Mariangela.
Yes, you know.
That is that, Kathy, I understand about having several doctors to go see, because I started having symptoms in 2002, and it took till 2004 and a round of doctors before we finally found out what was wrong with me. And many, many trips to the hospital, and it was very challenging. Not knowing, so I can completely understand having to run to the doctors and not know, and I empathize with you, Kathy.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I just feel like I'm isolated, and I know that there are very intelligent people out there, and they should really understand what we're going through and how much we really need attention as far as medicine and everything else. I appreciate you speaking to me on this also.
Oh, please. It's certainly our pleasure and our privilege. I think I'm just going to start right in now. And as people, you'll keep on hearing or possibly hear a little beep. That could be new people coming on. Not all of them will beep. So I'm going to just start so we can get the conversation going, and again, feel free to join in and respond when I'm done with my little brief.
Thank you.
Little introduction. So, on behalf of the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, known as AGMD, I would like to welcome you to our gastroparesis telephone internet community support group meeting. Before we begin, for those who don't know me, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Mariangela. That's my first name. DiGrazia DiTucci is the last name, and I'm a longtime patient who suffers from multiple digestive motility disorders, including gastroparesis and a host of non-digestive diseases. In 1991, I was extremely privileged to start this organization which is a nonprofit international organization which provides support, education, awareness, and advocacy and promotes further research in the specialized area of gastroenterology. During this program, I encourage you to share your questions, concerns, tips, and experiences as they relate to living with gastroparesis. We want to make sure that everybody has a chance to join in the conversation, so just be mindful of that, especially when we're short on time. And we also want to be respectful of other people's privacy, so don't ask for anybody's contact information during the program or give out your contact information. If you're interested in communicating with somebody, you can always just email me or call me and say I'm interested in responding and communicating with these particular people. And then I will be the conduit to ask them if they're willing. And lastly, before you start your conversation, be sure to just call out your first name, or if you don't like your first name, you can use an alias. And that way there we'll be able to relate the voice to a human being. And if you have trouble joining in the conversation, just call out Mary Angela, and I'll be certain to facilitate the conversation. I'd just like to make a few remarks about gastroparesis. For some, your journey may be just beginning, but for others, like me, you may be seasoned veterans in dealing with gastroparesis and all the many things that it encompasses. It can be very frightening to discover that you have gastroparesis. But it's important to remember that you're not alone. And in 2012, during our AGMD Digestive Motility Symposium, there was a doctor named Christopher Law. He's been part of our organization for years. And he did a presentation entitled 10 Myths About Gastroparesis. Dr. Law has worked with Dr. Thomas Abel, who actually developed the gastric neuro stimulator. And Dr. Lara is a surgeon who's implanted over 300 of these stimulators. One of the myths he addressed was that gastroparesis is psychological in nature. Another myth that he said was that one setting works for all. Another was pain is not a part of gastroparesis, and the list goes on. There are so many misconceptions out there, and the journey can be a very lonely one for the sufferer. But it's really important to know that you are not alone and that others, like all of us here today, really do understand. Patients may find that their symptoms do not correlate with what they have read or what other GP patients are going through. When I say GP, that's the acronym for gastroparesis. You may be confused, frustrated, and scared. Your symptoms may be unpredictable, compounding the emotional roller coaster. It's important to note that not all patients will experience vomiting. Not all patients will experience pain. Some patients are able to make dietary adjustments to their work that works for them, and while others are still trying to discover what they can or cannot eat. Some GP patients get full with just solids, some with liquids, some with both, some not at all. Some patients have a belly that descends. Some are patients of average weight. Some are overweight, some are obese, some are thin, some are very malnourished. Some patients may get reflux, others may not. Some patients may have intestinal involvement as well, and some may not. And there are so many potential causes of GP, from surgeries, medications, viruses, secondary to another disease such as diabetes, and idiopathic, to name a few. And it can certainly be a balancing act, both physically as well as emotionally. And I know for patients with gastroparesis as well as some of the other digestive motility disorders, it can be really hard to expect others to understand what you're going through when in fact it's hard for you to even understand. But I have found in my own experience in telling just the general public, that includes friends and relatives, that there are some people who will understand as much as they can understand, and certainly other gastroparesis patients do understand. There are some people who just will understand a little bit. There are some people who just won't understand and don't want to know, and there are some people who aren't capable of understanding. And as a result, I have learned who to tell, how much to tell, and if to tell based on that. So that's something that certainly came with experience, because at the beginning, when people didn't understand, it was so painful for me emotionally. You really expect people to understand, and especially people who are in your life that you think they're your friend or a loved one, and yet there are conditions on that, and that is that they begin to disappear if you cannot join them on social events, so that your commitment is yes and then it becomes no. They don't understand any aspect of what you're going through, and they just kind of disappear from your life, but you know where you stand. And with that, for anybody here today, if you'd like to begin telling us what brings you here today, and or if you have any questions, or you just want to describe your journey, and I just want to remind you to be sure to say your first name before you speak. Anybody here would like to begin? Enam, do you want to speak about anything that we talked about?
Yeah. With me, with the GP and the cerebral palsy, I find that with going with social functions, before the illness, I was diagnosed in 2002. Before the illness, I could go out. With the illness now, I still can go out, but I'm very choosy about, for example, what social functions I go to. Most of them I don't go to much anymore, like meetings, except these ones on the phone, because of the motility spec, so it's very challenging. But when I do go to doctors, I have to be very choosy about which ones I can, which people will help me, because there's some that will help, and I find those, you know, I tell them a little bit, and then if they're willing to help me, okay. If not, then I know I don't go out with them. For example, I have one friend that wants to go out with me, but she will not help at all with taking me to the bathroom, so therefore we don't go out, because she said to me one day, she said, "Why don't you want to go out with me?" And I said, "Well, you don't want to help me with the bathroom, and if I have to vomit, what do I do, you know, in public?" There have been times when one time I had gone to a restaurant, and I actually did have to have the waitress take me to the bathroom, and got down on my hands and knees on the dirty bathroom floor and vomited in the toilet, and that was really not pleasant. It's one thing doing it here at home. It's another doing it, you know, in the bath, in a public place. What I find is if it's a big social event, like I won the Bell Awards, I get to go every year, I find that I just don't eat during that event. I just tell them I need to box up the food because it's an evening affair. I need to box up the food, and I'll take it home with me because I have multiple disabilities. It took us three years to find out, and many different doctors to find out what exactly was wrong, because they hospitalized me at the beginning, and they, you know, did all these tests, and it's all in your head, it's all in your head. And I have the vomiting. Also, I have that my abdomen is slow. It doesn't, and my colon is slow, and then also my rectum is enlarged. It doesn't work, so I have to have enemas at night, and then I also have the incontinence with the bladder.
Kathy, do you have Excuse me 1 minute, Kathy?
Yes.
Are you still there?
Okay. Yes.
Do you have reflux?
No. The only problem I have is bloating and pains because of the food that's in sitting in my stomach. I'm not a diabetic. I only have hypertension, and it's controlled. And I don't sleep at nights, and I'm constantly going to the bathroom about 5 or 6 times just urinating. I can't move my bowels. That's my problem.
You can't. So you're suffering from constipation as well?
Yes.
And I don't know if this would work for you, Kathy. You might want to talk to your doctor first, because that's what I had to do. Have you tried, I can't do the Miralax or any of those agents. Have those worked, or have they mentioned? Now, with me, because I don't have sensation to know I need to go to the bathroom, I have enemas every night. Now, can you feel that you need to go, or do you not have sensation down there to know you need to go, Kat?
I have sensation. I was told I was on Linzess, I was on Amitiza, and I was on Miralax. I was told by a doctor in Shands, you could only get appointments every 3 months. So I went a couple weeks ago, 2 weeks, and she told me to stop all the medications and just take Miralax 2 to 3 times a day. And don't go, then add 1 Amitiza. And so far, every other day I go.
Okay. And when do you get bloating from liquids as well as solids, or just solids?
Yes.
Or certain foods?
From both.
Okay.
Yes.
So, all right. And has the doctor addressed dietary needs?
Yes, she did. She just told me to, she said right now, eat rice every single day with fresh vegetables.
Okay.
That's all she told me. And she said no fried foods, no fruits with skins. And she also told me to see her in 3 months, and that was it. I went to nutritionists, 2 different ones, and I asked them to help me, but they don't understand gastroparesis and what I really need. Mm-hmm. I really need a diet, you know, to know what to eat and what not to eat.
Yes. So let me just respond to your question there. First of all, what a food that may work for one may not necessarily work for another. So that's the thing. And usually the typical gastroparesis recommendation is to not have any fried foods that are really high in gas.
Okay.
Like cabbage, things like that. Foods that are, fatty foods. And also to eat what I call grazing, but mini meals throughout the day. That helps to keep your blood sugar okay, and it also helps to give the stomach time to empty. So those are a few factors. Now, a lot of patients juice, and they find that helpful. So if they're getting that bloating and they're getting all of those symptoms from gastroparesis from just having that solid food, they put it in more of a liquid consistency. Some have baby food. Some can supplement with Ensure or Boost or one of those other different protein-enriched supplemental things that you can get over the counter.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what works for one may not necessarily work for others. But those are some hints. Now, there is an excellent, along with our site, there's a lot of information at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. They have the head lady there of nutrition is an expert, and she has done presentations for our organization as well. And she has, yes, I'm sorry.
Her name, Kathy, is Carol Reese Parrish.
Thank you, Enam, because you could tell that I forgot her name, otherwise I would have mentioned it, right? Thank you. But they have on their website a lot of information on diet with gastroparesis. We also have actually two dietitians in our organization who have gastroparesis, and there's one in particular who isn't practicing now because she's had a lot of other medical problems, but she said all her life and her training was spent teaching people how to eat right. And then all of a sudden she gets gastroparesis, and what she was telling patients doesn't work for the gastroparetic patient. So she has to change her thought process. But as a dietitian, it goes against pretty much everything that she was espousing to people. So that's really, really a different take on it. But when you seek out a dietitian, there are no cookie cutter diets. Again, I keep on stressing what works for one patient might not necessarily work for another.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important. Gastroparesis is a specialized area of digestive gastroenterology to begin with. So you go to a gastroenterologist, they specialize in general gastroenterology. When you have a doctor who is a gastroenterologist who also then has a subspecialty in digestive motility, they have to go through further training on that. And then you have those specialists who then may sub-specialize in digestive motility, but specifically on gastroparesis or reflux, other things. And the same holds true for dietitians. So you have a lot of dietitians out there. And when you're presented to them, they may just be assuming from what you talk about that this is the cookie cutter recipe that you should follow. However, what is important is that you find a a dietitian who, first of all, is a registered dietitian, because there are a lot of health coaches out there who don't have that total background.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're a dietitian, you have to go through regular medical training for that. So it's a whole different ball of wax. And then you look for that dietitian who specializes in gastroparesis. On our website, we have a link. I don't know if you have access to our website, if you do internet at all, Kathy.
I don't do internet that much. I'm not a computer savvy person, but I'm just learning now.
Okay. Well, we can certainly help you with that and send you the information if that's the better way for you to obtain it. But we can, if you let me know your location, I probably have access to it in your registration. I'm not sure if you put that information down, but don't tell me now. I'm sorry?
I put all my address and information on the registration.
On the registration. Okay, so we can send you out some of that information so that you'll be able to obtain it. And if anybody else, we have more callers who have joined in on the line, if anybody else does not have internet access to our website, and that's our main website because we have an AGMD Inspire site, which is an online community, but we also have our main website, which is AGMD, thank you, Enam. And then there's a hyphen, gimotility.org. And there are links. There's a clinical, a nutrition central, we call it. And in there, there are a whole bunch of resources that you can click on the link. And one of them is to find dietitians in your state. And then you can research even further to find out which ones perhaps specialize in gastroparesis. That doesn't guarantee that there is one in your area who does it. We have a dietitian in Massachusetts who does, we have two that actually do phone consults as well. And they can help advise on the diets as well. And one of those from Massachusetts is, again, one who has gastroparesis. And there is another dietitian who doesn't have gastroparesis, but she's had other autoimmune disorders. Mm-hmm. And what she has found in her practice, she's from Massachusetts and licensed in Rhode Island as well, but what she has found is that a lot of patients have sensitivities or allergies to certain foods. Mm-hmm. And not only the foods themselves, but, which I was stunned because I'm Italian, as you can probably tell from my name, and Italians cook with basil, oregano, onions, garlic. Those are the basis of all of our meals. But in doing this particular, it's called the LEAP test, and it's a blood test where there are not a lot of dietitians who specialize in this, but it is a certain certification that they get. And they take this blood test, and what they do is, the blood test can reveal so many things that you wouldn't even think of. I mean, you might think of, I'm allergic to gluten. I have a gluten intolerance, dairy. But when it comes down to even a seasoning, as innocent as it may be to basil,
mm-hmm.
or paprika or something like that, this can tell that. And then from determining that, they remove those things from your diet. And then little by little, they reincorporate it. And I know a lot of patients have done this, and they've found great relief with it. But that's just one aspect. It may not. So it may not be a sensitivity or allergy to it. But the important thing to remember that it is individual. So even if you go to a dietitian who specializes in gastroparesis, you may find that what they're suggesting still isn't working for you. And it's important to have that rapport. You can just say that, to talk to the dietitian and say, look, I've tried all these things. It's still not working. And another point to remember, you may find that, oh, I'm able to eat this food. This is great. And then without warning, you may find, uh-oh, now I can't eat that food. Or I could eat it yesterday and now I can't. What's going on? So don't be discouraged. It's always trial and error. And you have to remember, like, well, gastroparesis, the really encouraging thing is that there's so much research being done, and our organization gets privy to a lot of the things that aren't even out there yet, of what potential therapies that they're at work on. And it is so encouraging to hear that some of these therapies are really now going into the phase 3 of clinical trials, which gets closer to the patient. But as one, I don't know if any of you have taken metoclopramine or Reglan.
I took Reglan.
And how did you do with that?
I didn't feel that it was helping me.
Okay. You didn't get any reaction from it?
No, I was on it for 2 years and no reaction.
Okay. So that's a good thing. Some people do get a reaction with the pill form of it, and what I was told to them, which makes sense, is that a lot of the reaction stems from, because the stomach isn't emptying properly, the pills cannot be metabolized the way they're supposed to. And as a result, you're holding on to the pill, and it's not going through your system the way it should, so it can't possibly work effectively, which is why a lot of patients get more severe potential side effects, or they just can't tolerate it. So as a result, they're now doing clinical trials on a nasal spray, which bypasses your intestinal tract, which makes for fewer side effects and more benefits. And they're doing that with diabetic gastroparesis women, and then another study with just men. So interesting things out there just to explore. We have some other people on this call. If you would like to just introduce yourself, you're welcome to. I just tell you to say your first name, and you can tell us what brings you here, or if you have any questions, or you just want to talk about your experiences. And then if you have trouble joining in the conversation, you can just call out my first name, which is Mary Angela, and I'll be sure to facilitate you into the conversation. Does anybody else like to join in with questions or any type of topic?
I would like to ask yes. a question. My name is Anya.
Sure.
And with regards to gastroparesis, I just started Reglan, and mm-hmm. I just wanted to see if anyone else has similar results. I noticed that the only difference when I do use Reglan is after about 20 minutes, I start getting really dizzy, and then mm-hmm. I feel like it just makes me more hungry, but I can't really tell if it's making any impact on my digestion. So I just wanted to see if anyone has anything to say about that.
That's a good question. How long have you been on that, Anya?
For about 2 weeks now. And I don't know if I'm supposed to be taking it when I'm also just drinking liquids, like protein mm-hmm. shakes, because that's mainly my diet until I go completely starving and I eat and I get sick.
Oh, my gosh. Does anybody else? I was on Reglan, but I had to be taken off it, and this was many years ago because my body, I got a reaction from it. Is there anybody else who has had that? And then I'm going to address that a little more. But I want to get anybody else's input. Yes? Say your first name.
This is Anam. Mm-hmm. And the only side effect that I take the Reglan once at bedtime because it makes me sleepy. So I just take it once at night because otherwise I can't function during the day because it makes me sleepy. But I've been on it and I had no reactions other than being sleepy from it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. And Kathy, you said you were on Reglan as well, correct?
Yes, I have, and I had no reactions at all. I didn't even think the pill was working.
And did you find? And how long were you on it?
I was on it for at least a good year and a half.
Oh, wow. And did you find it increased your appetite?
No, I always have an appetite. I can't understand it, but I'm always hungry and I'm always thirsty, and I'm trying to eat smaller meals each day, and the only thing, like I said, I'm taking in the morning, I'll drink Glucemia. I used to drink Boost, but then I got this aftertaste and I didn't like it, so I switched to Glucemia, and then 2 hours later, I usually have a full meal, which consists of a half a cup of rice and a couple of vegetables, and that's it. And I'll drink iced tea with the Miralax, and I'm finished for the rest of the day. And about mm-hmm. for night, for dinner, I'll just have a couple of pieces of fruit, and I'm finished.
Okay. It's so important to have that nourishment because if you, like in my case, I'm very malnourished, you don't want to get to that point. So it's important that either you see a dietitian who understands and also trial and error, but you don't want to reach a point where you are getting that nutrition is compromised to that degree, in which case then you may either temporarily to give your gut a little bit of a vacation, you may, or a permanently pending, but you might want to then consider going on the tubal feeding, which that would be with your doctor that you'd be in conjunction with. But getting back to Sonia's question about the Reglan, it varies from patient to patient. That's the thread of everything. But also, I suggest to all patients that in order to find out about any medication and to see if, well, it's stimulating the appetite, is it from the medication or is it possibly just from something else? We don't know. Hormonal. So my take is to make very good friends with your pharmacist, because the pharmacist, that's their specialty. They go to school specifically to learn about all of the different drugs. They're updated. They have to have continuing education every year, and they would be able to tell you more, like how long does it take before you should find some sort of an effect with Reglan. Would the increased appetite be a result of that? Not a bad, not necessarily a bad side effect, but is that from this or could it be from something else? Sonia, I don't know if you've talked to a pharmacist about it.
Thank you. Actually, my doctor indicated that it would increase my appetite because it would stimulate the stomach muscles. So mm-hmm. I feel increased appetite as a result of more growling, which I feel after I take the medication. But in the same situation, I get really dizzy and sleepy. So you want to eat, but you're too tired to eat, but you force yourself to it so you could yeah. have the energy.
How long have you had gastroparesis, Sonia?
I was just diagnosed since November, and I'm experiencing now a lot of pain underneath, like, the rib cage, and I don't know mm-hmm. if that's something that's normal to gastroparesis, but I'm
okay.
predominantly on liquid diet.
All right. So during the beginning of the program, which I think you came in a little bit later, I was talking about how varied the symptoms can be from patient to patient, and that during a 2012 symposium that there was actually a doctor talking about 10 myths about gastroparesis, and one of them was about pain. Not all gastroparetic patients experience pain, but there are some that do, and I know a lot of patients when they've gone to the doctor doesn't believe that there's a pain that accompanies that, but a lot of doctors with expertise in gastroparesis realize that there is and there can be an associated pain to that. So what you're feeling as far as the pain is concerned can actually be part of gastroparesis. Of course, it could be something else going on, but when you're saying that pain, that's not uncommon. Another thing is the belly distension. Not all patients get the belly distension, but I know so many that do. And no matter how much or how little they're eating, they look like they have they're pregnant.
Yes.
I don't know. Yes. So, and the belly is very, very hard. Some people can eat a bit more and maybe not even feel that fullness, and then all of a sudden the break comes on. Some people don't have fullness at all, and some people do have that fullness. Some people are able to tolerate solids. That's the most common thing, that people cannot tolerate solids because that's when the symptoms get worse. Some people have no problems with liquids. Some people they're finding just have problems with liquids and not solids. And some people like me have both, and some of the other callers here have both, an intolerance to the solids as well as liquids, no matter what, even if it's a sip of water or if it's eating the same food that you eat every day. So that's another thing that patients don't realize. Some patients experience vomiting. Some patients don't. Some patients experience nausea all the time. Some patients don't. Some patients, like me and some of the other callers, experience both. So just because you may read, you have to have this, it's the classic signs of gastroparesis, but you don't quite fit in that slot because you're not having all of those symptoms, you don't be concerned. If you need to be concerned because it's your health, but if you have a doctor that has diagnosed you with that and you're being monitored, you can rest assured that you may not fit into that whole aspect of what they say. This is the profile of gastroparesis. All of us may be a little bit different. And some people, even with their weight, some people, and excuse me for recapitulating this to all those who were on the call earlier, but some patients are average weight, some are overweight, some are obese, some are very thin, some are emaciated. You can't tell. You can't. And some people are ill, look ill, and some people you never know by looking at them that they're suffering so greatly. So I'm sure every single one on this call can fit into one of those slots that I was talking about. Do any of you here have vomiting?
Yes.
No.
Okay. No. And do any of you here have 24-hour nausea?
No.
Okay. Do any of you here not have any nausea or vomiting?
No, I have none. Never had
okay.
it. Happy.
Wow. That's good. We got to look at the good parts and not just focusing on all of the challenges that are before you. But that's good. A lot of people, I'm wondering, are able to eat certain things but not. But I wonder if any of you here do any juicing.
No.
No. Okay. So that's another thing, and excuse me for repeating this, but a lot of patients have found that by taking fruits and vegetables that they can't tolerate, just eating them cooked or the regular way, will actually juice them down. And they create different recipes, like soups with them. We have some recipes on our website, but and the ones that we have been used by dietitians, but certainly we can help you with that, and a dietitian can help you with that. It can be so challenging to figure out what you can take, what you can't, and it's even more challenging when you have an appetite. You really want to eat, you're hungry, and there comes that emotional component, too, that you're dealing with. I mean, eating is a natural part of life, as is going to the bathroom. So the impact this has psychologically, as well as socially and all the rest that goes with it, is huge. So when you're hungry and you're looking at that food and you really want it, and sometimes you take the plunge and say, oh, well, I really want it anyway, I'm going to have it, knowing you'll suffer the consequences, that's all a part of trying to accept your illness. I know, Sonia, now you have that hunger. How do you deal with that hunger and trying to eat? Sonia, still there?
Yes. I'm mainly on liquid protein diet because I can't have any fiber. And I did notice that when I do eat regular food, I have problem with stomach acid.
Mm-hmm. So you have that reflux, yeah.
Yes. So I have to stay on a schedule to keep intaking protein shakes every 3 hours. But then I noticed also, and I don't know if anyone has that problem too, where I do consume a lot of liquid, a lot of water and protein shakes, and I've noticed that a lot of liquid is just stuck in my intestines.
Yeah.
Sonia, I have a problem. This is an I have a problem with solids, but I also have a problem with liquids. A sip of water makes me feel bloated. I drink the protein shakes as well, and I get very full and bloated from just even liquid, solids and liquids both. So I can understand.
Yeah, sometimes it's mind over matter, and I know in my case, but I have chronic idiopathic intestinal food obstruction, which has affected, it's progressed to my entire digestive tract as well as bladder and biliary area. But I know in my case, people who are trying to lose weight, they often encourage people to drink a lot of water, because that's also filling. So when you have that problem with a motility and you're trying to get that protein into you and you're trying to get a water in you, it's filling by nature in a normal person, let alone when you have that, but it's so important that you do consume that. So your idea of getting that protein into you is really important. And to me, I'm always amazed at how patients, once they leave the doctor's office, they tend to experiment on their own. And everybody comes up with their own little protocol of what they do in order to tolerate the symptoms, and some days may be better than others, and you just have to imagine. I always make the analogy that if you take a balloon and you blow it up, or fill it with water, that all of a sudden becomes expands. And it's not going to go anywhere unless there's some sort of a release. But if you are holding the top end and holding the bottom end, and you have that all filled up, if it's not going to go down, the top part, if you release only the top part, it's going to go up. And that's why a lot of patients then end up having that reflux. So,
I do actually have one recommendation. What I started to do, and I've done a lot of research on trying to find treatment options, I have this small massager, and right after I feel that way, I massage my stomach, and that helps quite a bit with movement of fluids and digestion.
Yeah, excellent suggestion, and I would like to capitalize on that just a bit. Alternative therapies can certainly be good potentials, as well as the regular medical things that are out there. And one thing is that of massage. And so Sonia has indicated how that really has helped her. So she's massaging her abdomen or her stomach. Where exactly are you doing the massage?
It's the abdomen. I basically lay down on a massager, and it stimulates my entire stomach, and I move it around, so it moves in different areas.
Oh, that's great. Some people, especially if you have constipation, can actually take your hands, and there is a system to that, where you can literally move the contents if you're able to even tolerate anything on your abdomen, but you can take the base of your hand and move that along the lines of your intestinal tract, and you can do that while lying down, or you can do it actually when you're on the toilet seat, and that can help a lot. Another thing which some patients have found which is helpful in constipation, as well as gastroparesis, as well as reflux, as well as any other esophageal spasm or abdominal spasm that you may have, so it helps with pain as well, is especially when you're in a flare-up, the spine is a very important element within controlling the digestive tract, along with, the GI tract is so complicated, it's governed by so many systems within your body. So in doing the massage, you can actually, if you can't do it yourself, you can get somebody to do it, if somebody is available, is to massage your back. And by doing that massage, that helps to ease pain, and it also can help, by easing the pain, ease spasms, which in turn can provide some movement. So I don't know if any of you other people have try that, but certainly it works in some patients. Have any of you, any other people tried that?
No, and thank you, Sonia. My name is Kathy. Thank you for telling me, and I will buy a little massager and see if that helps, because I have bloating and pain under my ribs constantly.
Yeah. Oh. I wonder, too, if any of you actually do have back pain. And the reason why I ask that is, and if you don't, that's great. But a lot of patients, especially when their belly is distended, it puts a lot of pressure on your back. And so a lot of patients do end up having back aches or discomfort. And so if you don't have it, that's great. Doesn't mean that you're going to get it. It just means that it could potentially be related to that. It could be other things, but it could potentially be related to that. Yes, Ina.
Occasionally, when I get when my belly gets really, really full and I go on to the bathroom, I notice they do get the lower back pain, I could tell it's really real because my belly's really full and bloated. Sometimes I get lower back pain and I didn't know. I can tell if I get really, really full, and I haven't gone for several days, I get it, but otherwise I don't. Just when I get really, really bloated and full, sometimes I do get the lower back pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So massage may be a good thing. I'm a proponent of it only because I know that it has helped me, knowing that it might not necessarily help you, but certainly it's a tip, and we try to look for any types of tips that provide relief. Or if it's working for one patient, it may potentially work for you, and certainly things that are not invasive to try. I don't know if any of you have knowledge about the neurogastric stimulator. Have any
yes.
of you?
I worked okay. in a hospital in New Jersey. I'm a cardiovascular tech. I used to work with
wow.
doctors putting stents in the heart. I know about the simulator because my daughter works for a company that uses them. And
is that Medtronic?
Yes, she works for Medtronic, and she had told me that a couple of times that they have been used, but not very successful in them.
Yeah. And how long ago was that?
That was about a year ago.
Okay. So, again, what works for one patient may not work for the other. Laura is a patient with gastroparesis. She's also a diabetic, and she volunteers for the organization, and she usually is on these calls, but unfortunately was unable to attend today. But she was one of the first patients in years ago, but our first symposium was in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2005, I think, is the first time she attended the symposium, and one of the doctors, Dr. Richard McCallum, who was very much involved in the production of the, with Medtronic on the enteric therapy, he had her as a patient in his trial, and he, in the middle of the conference, all of a sudden stopped. Now, people who know me know that I'm a very precise person. I like to have everything organized and follow the schedule. And all of a sudden, he just pulled Laura out of the audience in the middle of it and said, Laura, let's tell everybody about this experience. And I was horrified. Wait a minute. This isn't on the paper. What are you doing? But as a result, I met Laura. And during that time, she was explaining about her experience with the neurogastric stimulator. And
mm-hmm.
in addition to that, then she became part of the organization after that, years after that, and she had to have it replaced. But she has found she was having multiple emergency visits because mm-hmm. of the vomiting and pain and all of that. And when she got it replaced, which is done very differently than it was in those days, that has made an incredible difference in her life. But what is found is it's not going to help stimulate the gut per se. But what it does is it works on the nausea signal. And by preventing the nausea and vomiting to happen, it increases the appetite, enabling patients to eat a little bit more and to get that nourishment. So a lot of people think, oh, it works like a regular pacer and it's going to help to move the gut. That
but it doesn't.
No, it's just working on that signal, enabling patients to be able to eat because now they don't experience that nausea and vomiting. So just to get that information out. But, it works for some, doesn't work for others. But now when they do it, they do it so that there's a little test. Instead of implanting the whole thing in your stomach, what they do now is they do like a test one. So they put everything in your stomach, but I believe that they don't have the device totally in there. I forget what she said. But if it doesn't work in a certain amount of time, then you're not going to be a candidate for it to be implanted.
Right.
But if it does work, then they go ahead with the implantation of it. And it's done very minimally as far as being invasive in the body compared to the way it used to be done. So they're making headway, and I keep on reiterating as well that the different types of clinical trials that are out there, and on our main website, we have this information if you're interested in participating in a clinical trial, but there is just so much out there now with different studies. So that's the really encouraging part. And, you know, sometimes so many patients, when they leave the doctor's office, they end up coming home with so many questions and nowhere to turn. But by sharing information and tips, like Sonia talking about that massage therapy, that's a huge thing. That can make an incredible difference, not only with gastroparesis, but constipation. So, you know, those show people having the courage to try different things and having the wherewithal to evaluate what is going to work for them and what isn't. So if you need dietitians and you don't have access to the internet, you can let me know, send me an email or give me a call, and I can do that for you. We can send you out info. If you need information on clinical trials and you don't have access to our website, we can provide you with that. Does anybody else have any questions or concerns that they want to address before we close?
Mary Angela, I would just like to know, do you take a multivitamin or B12 and iron every day?
Okay. Me personally, I have pernicious anemia, so my body does not create that, whatever it is that you need in order to absorb the B12. So because of that, yes, I do have to take B12 injections, and I take them twice a month. People do end up taking iron shots if they need it. Sometimes they have iron transfusions. Multivitamin, yes, a lot of I have trouble tolerating vitamins, so unfortunately I don't. But a lot of patients do take a multivitamin, especially when you have an impaired digestive tract. Some take a liquid vitamin because it's more readily absorbed. Some people take it in a powdered form and then put it in their drink. And again, a dietitian can advise onto what would be best. Calcium is important. Vitamin D is really important. And just because a lot of us have limited diets, it could just be one trace thing that's out of whack that can cause other problems. So you want to make sure that what you're taking is really being absorbed properly. Is anybody else taking a multivitamin? No, okay. But a dietitian is a good resource for that because they would be able to tell. And there are tests to tell if you have that B12 deficiency or not. Mm-hmm. Have you been tested for iron deficiency and B12 deficiency?
No, I haven't, but I will ask my primary to do that for me.
Yeah, that's important because if you're fine with all of that, then it's one less thing you have to do or take. But if you're not, and you're, so are you getting very fatigued?
No, I'm not. I'm not at all. I just wanted to know because I stopped taking multivitamins and Caltrate D.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to get on a vitamin, and I just feel because I'm not eating enough of food that I really need to take a vitamin.
Okay.
So I thought I'd take calcium citrate plus with magnesium, you know, because I'm not any vitamins, and I don't eat that much. I only eat two meals a day.
Yeah. It may not necessarily be the quantity, but it may be the type of things that you're eating that may govern it more, but I'm not a dietitian. When you ask the doctor, B12 is a special test that they have to take, but ask for not only the CBC, which is a general blood check, but you want to make sure that your electrolytes are all good, because if you're taking something with magnesium, you don't want that to disturb the balance your body. And a word of warning for those who take something like Tums or Rolaids, the over-the-counter things that you chew, sometimes what happens is you get a rebound effect if you have reflux, and it may be good for 20 minutes, and then all of a sudden you say, oh, I need to take another one and another one. And some of those have magnesium in there, and if you're taking a lot of it, it can really disturb the balance in your body. So be mindful of that.
Mary Angela, when you
mentioned, yes,
this mm-hmm. is not when you mentioned about vitamins, I do take vitamin D because I do have a vitamin D deficiency. So mm-hmm. I'm on vitamin D, but that's all I'm on.
Okay. And I know there are a lot of dietitians that may refer you to different name brands of vitamins that are better, that don't have a lot of the fillers in it, things like that. But you can do some exploring yourself and look as well just to see and then ask, is this a good one? Do you think that this would be good? Sometimes vitamins are not readily regulated in the United States, so you can't guarantee that what they're saying is really true to form. I wish they really would regulate it more strongly, and hopefully in the future they will. Inam, did you have something to say?
No.
Okay. Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time right now, and I have to close before the program just ends abruptly. But I just want to thank you all for joining us here today, for those who shared your experiences and questions and your tips. I really appreciate you coming to the table and telling us about it. I also, for those who are quiet and just listening, I hope that you got a lot out of this. But traveling through your gastroparesis journey, I'm sure very difficult, it can be very isolating, and oftentimes you may feel that you're very much alone as you struggle with your daily living of it. I just pray that today, without just this meeting, you'll first of all be reminded that you're not alone and that all of us are suffering with gastroparesis, and we understand absolutely what you're going through. Even though we may have different symptoms, we may have different experiences, we all understand. And just to remind you that our organization is here to help in any way that we can. If you can visit our website, it's www.agmd-gimotility.org, or you can call or mail us for more information and to keep up to date on the programs. You're always welcome, and remember, this organization is yours. You can be as active in it as you like, or you can participate through groups like this. Our next gastroparesis meeting is in June Thursday on the 26th. And then, we have some other programs that are also there for patients who have esophageal problems. We have one that's on June 24th. And we also have our Let's Talk series. The Let's Talk series is an open discussion with anybody who wants to join in the conversation. And each month we focus on a particular topic. Like this month it was, it's all in your head, being believed. Next month it's going to be testing relationships. I always like to close these meetings with a personal sentiment, and that is that I am just so humbled by all of you being here and telling us about your experiences and just listening. And it is with such a grateful heart that I want you to know you have all touched my heart, and in my eyes, you are just such incredible heroes. It's been an honor to have you with us today, and I thank you again, and may God bless you all. Please stay in touch and call or email if we can help you in any way. God bless.
Same here. Thank you, Mary Angela. God bless.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.